You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Brad Loncar, and my co-hosts today are Daphne Zohar, Luba Greenwood, Eric Schmidt, and we have a special guest today who will be talking about a really interesting tweet thread and something he did with his business recently, Ali Mortazavi. For more information about our host and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. And it's always nice to have M&A to talk about. And this week we actually had a historic piece of M&A because Vertex did the biggest deal that it's ever done. And you know, this has been closely watched. They've been printing so much cash over the years. Everyone's been kind of wondering, will they ever pull the trigger on a big deal? And I think another surprise here is the space that they did it in. So I'm going to kick it over to Eric and ask him to talk about this deal where they're acquiring Alpine Immune Sciences. Eric?
Thank you, Brad. Great to be with this esteemed group again. I'm sure most of our listeners saw the news that Vertex is going to be buying Alpine Immune Sciences for about $5 billion in cash. Not only is this the largest deal in Vertex's history, Brad, but it's also the largest deal for the sector in 2024. So maybe we need to see some additional greater than $5 billion deals to get people pretty excited here. But certainly, this is a meaningful deal, and I think the first meaningful deal we've had now in several months. The other thing about this deal is that it's in a very hot area of nephrology, which is undergoing some rapid transformation. So maybe we'll talk more about that in a moment. And thirdly, just kind of mention Alpine CEO Mitch Gold. There's some redemption here. Mitch has done a great job with Alpine Immune Sciences, but many will also remember Mitch from his Dendreon days, and that's a company that went out with a whimper, not a bang. So congrats to Mitch for getting it right the second time around. Okay, what's going on here? Alpine has a candidate that modulates B-cell activity by blocking two signaling molecules, BAFF and APRIL. And really over the last 12 plus months or so, it's become increasingly clear that B-cell modulation provides for potentially disease-modifying effects in an indication called IgA nephropathy or IgAN, which is essentially a chronic progressive kidney disorder that often leads to kidney failure. This is a huge indication. We think easily multi-billion dollar kind of market size here. And there are also some other kidney diseases where B-cell modulation, BAFF and APRIL, might play. So this could be potentially, a multi-blockbuster sort of a product in a pipeline opportunity. Alpine is not alone here, though Vertex has asserted that the Alpine drug, povetacicept, may have best-in-class properties. There are other players. Chinook, a company that was acquired last year by Novartis and really kind of kicked off the acquisition craze in renal disease is certainly active. Chinook has an inhibitor of APRIL. There's also another company called Vera that has a BAFF APRIL inhibitor called atacicept, and that's in phase three, probably in the lead actually in terms of development timelines. My strong suspicion is now that both Chinook and Alpine have been acquired. Vera probably has a pretty firm target on its back, and indeed the stock is acting like it has just that. It's up about 30% on the week. So a lot of cool stuff going on in this indication. In addition, again, to IgANs, these drugs could all move into lupus nephritis. So exciting times in kidney disease.
And Eric, can you talk about, like, Vertex, their big acquisition being in this space specifically, like, why is it a fit for Vertex, and what does it say about biotech? Like, this fits into the I&I category, and I think, a lot of us kind of feel that there's been a little less emphasis on oncology lately and a little more emphasis on I&I. Can you talk about that from, like, a macro level?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that, obviously Vertex came to fame as a cystic fibrosis company, and they've mined that opportunity extremely well over the last 10 or so years and have built a huge franchise, huge base business in cystic fibrosis. And they have been trying to find their one-two punch, their second opportunity now for some time. They've got a pretty good pipeline of other kidney disease candidates. So yes, you're right, Brad, that this is sort of an INI modulator of kidney function, but I think Vertex probably views this more as a pure nephrology play, at least for now. And it does fit, I think, well with the company's pipeline candidates that target ApoCKD and some other kidney disease indications. So I think there is a clear directional change in Vertex's strategy to go into kidney disease, and it makes sense given that there aren't a whole lot of big players in that space. If they went into more of the traditional INI space, I think they'd encounter some very large competitors and might not have quite as much of an advantage. So strategically, yeah, in retrospect, it makes a lot of sense. I wish I had called it in advance. We certainly did not.
Cool. And lastly, I'll just say to kind of pitch my own thing. I visited Vera in South San Francisco about a month ago for Biotech TV and did a really great overview of this whole space with the CEO. So if anyone's looking to like catch up on what all this is about, definitely check out that video. I'm gonna kick things over to Luba now. So Luba, the XBI. We've had a good year and people have been happy about it, but we did hit triple digits and we've had like what's now actually a pretty substantial pullback. So the sec it's back in the 80s and we're getting thrown around with the rest of the stock market with all like inflation and interest rates and all of that. And there was a big reading this week of this consumer price index that's affected everything. And so I know you wanted to kind of highlight that and talk about how it may or may not be affecting our sector.
Brad, thank you so much. Absolutely agree with you. I think as we saw, the recent inflation report showed increase in consumer prices that actually the CPI went from in February 3.2% increase to 3.5% in March. And this did cause stocks to go down, everything from Dow Jones to S&P 500 to NASDAQ and to XBI losing about 1%. So now what the investors are looking at is to see if the Fed is going to cut rates this year. I think the general consensus is most, of course, we don't know the future, but the consensus is probably won't happen in July. Maybe happen with in September, especially in with the election season coming up. But so what does that have in terms of the effect? Of course, the XBI moves with the other stock. It's not all doom and gloom. Yes, of course, for the smaller market cap companies, not just biotech, but it does so happen that biotech, there's the majority of them are in the smaller market cap. They are going to be hit the most, and they have been hit the most with this trend. And sadly, it is going to continue most likely for them until most likely September. This usually does happen, this effect on the smaller market cap companies as they're most exposed to high interest rate issues, such as if they're going to get debt financing and others. So that is still bad news for them. However, if you look at larger biotech companies as well as private companies and the financing for those and availability of cash and cheap money from LPs to the funds, the situation is looking a little better. You do have a fairly strong U.S. economy, and U.S. economy has been more resilient as opposed to Europe and Asia. So those investors looking to diversify are looking more into the U.S., U.S.-based companies, including more on the alternative investment side in biotech. So as a result, we do see focus of LPs is back, not at the same levels as, of course, we had before, but back into getting more money into VCs that invest and build companies in the US, especially in the area of biotech. We've seen some more research coming up most recently that VCs investing in biotech over the last 5 to 6 years have done very well compared to other industries in the same investment thesis. And so appetite does continue to increase from the lows, of course, of last year. And we see more interest and action of investing into funds. And when it used to take much longer, even 2-3 months ago to raise, things are certainly heating up for many of the funds today.
Any of our other panelists like to comment on that? I know we always like focus on kind of like what's in front of us, like, you know, from a biotech and like science standpoint, but, you know, interest rates really have been the thing that have been throwing things around, and it's created this environment where, you know, our funding situation has finally started to open up and we've seen all these private deals. I guess, is anybody worried that that this could, you know, start to turn the tide and you know, bring us back to where we were last year or the year before with just much less deal activity, or is it not that big of an issue?
Yeah, so Brad, I think one of the biggest drivers for our industry, as we've talked about a lot, is M&A. And that, you know, there's a few things that make me bullish about M&A. First of all, you know, we're seeing that pick up, obviously, but the looming patent cliffs, but also IRA, I actually think is quite bullish for M&A because it puts more pressure on the large pharma companies to fill their pipeline. So I think for those reasons, what we're seeing, you know, the more, if M&A continues, and, you know, we saw a little bit of a slower start to the year, but obviously the deal with Vertex was a good one. If it continues, I think that there will be less impact, but I'd love to hear from others as well.
Yeah, can I just add, Daphne, too, on that? I absolutely agree with you on that. You know, we saw this back in 2000, after 2008, 2009, when there was no deal activity, no IPO, and then when there was a potential window for IPO starting to open up, that's when pharma, and actually patent cliff, some of the patent cliffs had similar, were in a similar place at the time with many of the big blockbuster drugs. And so what we saw that was interesting is that's when pharma starts on the M&A side thinking, oh gosh, you know, we better get some of these good deals now before the IPO window opens up. So I agree. I am pretty bullish on that. And I think it may, if anything, continue.
Yeah, I also, this is Eric, I also agree that a stable market is a probably better market than, say, you know, huge upswing or downswing kind of market as far as M&A goes. It's much easier, I think, to find the appropriate price on a particular transaction if the markets aren't going crazy in either direction. I'd also say that, you know, from an investor standpoint, many of our clients, many buy-siders really relish today's tape. You know, we don't really have some kind of influx of generalist investors that makes things particularly volatile. We don't have some crazy, you know, IPO calendars that distract folks. That obviously would be good for private companies, but for public market investors, they'd rather kind of sift through the existing companies, and there are plenty of them to look at. We don't have really, you know, a major swing in interest rates. Obviously, rates have picked up a little bit, but it's not like it was at all, either rates going down or up over the last 18 months. So this to me smacks of a real great environment to pick stocks, and the stocks seem to be reacting judiciously as well. Those companies with good news are seeing their stocks accorded higher value, and when we have disappointing news, we see the appropriate reactions too. So, you know, this isn't a terrible market, and for those companies that do have good news, we're still seeing the ability to finance.
Hey, Brad, Ali here from London. I'm going to be, I guess, talking about the trials and tribulations of the UK, but maybe there's also the same mini theme going on in the US and globally where, you know, on a slightly sort of negative note, that, you know, a fundamental question is being asked, what's the kind of minimum market cap of an IPO? Is, you know, what is a small cap company? You know, when should a company list? Is there any institutional interest below a certain market cap? To my mind, even in the US, which is obviously enormously more liquid than the US, UK market, there's definitely a shrinkage, a material shrinkage of available interest and capital in small companies. Now, where that cutoff is, I'm not sure, but I think there's other themes going on. For example, the very large tech companies are sucking a lot of liquidity out of the small company markets in general because there's so much kind of volatility there, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just a kind of concept that I think is an open question globally.
All right. Moving on, real quick. This week was this last weekend and early this week was AACR. So if there's you know, any oncology people out there, you know, AACR is always like semi-interesting. The catch is it's always very early stage technology. So you don't get, you know, you have a lot of preclinical abstracts and like phase one trials, and you don't really get like blockbuster phase threes. Although a few years ago when the PD-L1, when Merck had the huge success in combination with chemo in lung cancer, they actually presented it there because the timing worked. But usually this is a very early stage cancer research conference, but it is interesting because it kind of tells you like where the puck is going. And I think universally there was kind of two main things that people were talking about coming into and coming out of this conference. And the first one is cancer vaccines. And, you know, when Moderna had, when Moderna and Merck had their initial data about a couple of years ago now, it really kind of rejuvenated the entire field after, you know, so many decades of failures. Actually talking, you know, coincidentally, speaking of Mitch Gold, you know, Provenge was really today really the only cancer vaccine that's ever been approved. So there were a couple interesting abstracts at AACR. And I think the one that caught most people's attention was BioNTech. And they just really showed how durable they're seeing like T cell responses with their vaccine. So they have a pancreatic cancer program, and they have 3-year data at this year's AACR showing that, you know, there's T cells that are still active that are, you know, directly from the cancer vaccine. And then there was a French company that had some intriguing data from head and neck cancer. And so I think we're going to be talking about cancer vaccines a lot over the next, you know, 5 or so years. So that's definitely one area of interest. And then for sure also like the pan-RAS inhibitors. You know, the G12Cs were a very important scientific achievement, of course, you know, after so many years and decades of trying to drug KRAS, but that is a very niche area, and those have been commercially, you know, not very strong launches. And we've also had controversy with you know, the recent AdCom that Amgen had to go through with their program based off of their accelerated approval. But I think that, you know, like anything in medicine and science, like you have a first modest success in something, and then, you know, people build off of that. And there were a lot of abstracts showing really interesting research in like the KRAS and like with like pan-RAS inhibitors. And so I think that those would really be the two macro takeaways from AACR, that those are going to be kind of two major areas that we're going to be talking about. I'm going to kick it over to Daphne now. Daphne, first of all, you're very modest when what you helped put together our program today, and you did not include your own news. And that was really big news. So of course everyone saw that you're now the CEO of Seaport Therapeutics, and, you know, focusing on the neuropsychiatry space. Congratulations. That was really exciting and really nice to see that news. And you made a huge splash. So if you'd like to say something about that, please do. But I also wanted to kick it over to you because a couple of our previous hangouts, you've been away where we've talked about what's going on with bio and like the whole Biosecurity Act and everything that happened with, you know, WuXi AppTec and WuXi Biologics and like all of that. And I know that you have some thoughts on, now that all of that has happened, like what the Biosecurity Act means and like, you know, how companies should think about it and how it might affect everybody. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about Seaport, and then if you can, your thoughts on the Biosecurity Act.
Yeah, thanks so much, Brad. It was an exciting week. It was actually for me a pretty big milestone after almost 20 years of building PureTech and running that company, and really, really proud of everything we've accomplished there. And you know, one of the things that we did when we were working on a number of different new medicines that we developed was obviously the KarXT program, and I co-founded Karuna together with Steve Paul and others. So we've been in touch with Steve over the last, you know, all the time, of course, but over the last few months, as our Glyph platform and our programs in neuropsychiatry have been advancing. And so I was really super, super excited that he wanted to join me to co-found Seaport. And, you know, the Seaport strategy is very much echoing the fundamentals of what the team did with Karuna. So we focused on a big need, and I'll say more about the need because I'm really quite passionate about this area. And that's anxiety and depression and the overlap between those two conditions. But the strategy is really to start with active drugs that originally had some liabilities and then applying a new technology to address those limitations. And, you know, in this case, we have, in the case of KarXT, we came up with this idea of the muscarinic agonist-antagonist combination. In this case, we actually have a platform called Glyph, and that's generated a pipeline, and there's, you know, novel composition of matter IP. So I kind of like to call it Karuna on steroids. So, you know, in terms of the unmet need, I really want to say a few words about this because there's a huge need for new treatments for depression and anxiety, and in particularly the overlap between the two conditions. There's rising anxiety, depression, suicidality. There's hardly any families that are not affected. I have several individuals in my family that have depression and anxious depression. And, you know, one of the biggest things that struck me recently is that suicide is one of the top causes of death in this country. And in some age groups, notably adolescents, more people die from suicide than homicide. But many commercially successful drugs have limitations. So there's drugs, but they don't really work for many patients. A third of the patients don't respond. They have side effects. And, you know, for some forms of depression, like anxious depression, the response rate is even worse to standard of care drugs. So the thing that is exciting to me is that we know that they're really promising new modalities that have shown efficacy in patients but had limitations. So they're just sitting on a shelf, or they're not really advancing. And so the idea that you could actually affect those with a platform like Glyph to overcome those liabilities, whether they be low oral bioavailability or hepatotoxicity, is really exciting. So that was an exciting week, a very busy week, you know, thank you for asking me about it. In terms of the situation at Bio, so there's a few different things, and I'm going to actually kick it over to Luba to talk about the Biosecure Act. But I do want to say that you know, one of the things that we saw this last week was that Nick Shipley, who is their head of advocacy at Bio, left. There's a really great individual that's taken his place. But, it's clear that that's not, there's a little bit of dialogue about what we should be doing here. And, one of the things that I would note is that there's a lot of concern, you know, as I talk to people in the industry about, you know, extricating the, you know, the companies from working with companies like WuXi. And the impact that that's going to have on the industry. So I think that on the one hand, national security is important, and it is, I think, exciting in some ways that the industry has something to talk about with members of Congress that, you know, is different from drug pricing. And, you know, this concept of almost creating like a CHIPS Act for the biotech industry is really, I think, intriguing and could help with the industry's reputation and with some of the pressures we're seeing around drug pricing. But at the same time, there are really great companies that are based in China. And so there's some concern about that. I'd love to hear from Luba, and then I'll make a related point about drug pricing with regard to Regeneron.
Yeah, absolutely. And Daphne, congratulations again. I'm very excited that I was there at the beginning of the week of
yes.
the journey.
So. We were having dinner when the deal was about to close, so it was kind of fun. I couldn't talk about it because
I know.
Yeah, but they knew that something was happening.
Anyway. I know. Well, congratulations, and you're absolutely right. I mean, seeing such an important area covered, and I love the approach that you're also taking. So I will be following very closely. So congratulations. And so on the Biosecurity Act, it's interesting. I completely agree that it's wonderful finally to have a discussion at the national and federal and local level of something outside of the IRA, and something that also showcases how hard the industry really works and how interconnected the pharma and the biotech space is. So it's not just, it's something that sometimes, you know, we lose track of when we talk in particular about drug pricing or when we talk about patents affecting pharma companies. So this is a good way to look at the industry more holistically and the role that it plays really in the United States and as an industry for patients and the economy and the market and globally. There has been a lot of conversation, I would say, over the last month, as you said, and including on this podcast and probably every other healthcare podcast, on the meaning of Biosecurity Act and what the implications are, and reading the fine print and understanding the interpretation as it's actually right now looked at and written pretty broadly, and understanding, for example, does this only apply to when it's tied to government funding and other issues? So there are a lot of people talking about that. A lot of people focused on larger geopolitical issues, making public policy statements. I am myself on the board of MassBio organization. And we, of course, think very carefully about the possible implications of this to our members. So meeting pretty much every biotech company in Boston, as well as a pharma company and CRO in Boston. But what I'd like to focus here a bit is a little more practical and immediate. We are coming to the end of Q1 board meetings, and I'm sure as all the listeners on the here, probably many are either investors or at companies, at biotech companies or pharma. And I have to say, every board meeting, this question is raised. Biotech companies are looking for alternatives to using WuXi. And actually, some use WuXi directly, as we know. Others are finding out that they're engaging third parties and they didn't realize that they were also using WuXi. So for our companies and companies I'm on a board of, we are looking and developing solutions that we are implementing immediately. And those include finding alternatives for everything that we do, from small molecule design to screening to product manufacturing to trials. And everyone I talk to thinks that they are the fastest and the smartest one, and that they will change their service provider, while others are kind of continuing this discussion and going to wait and see what happens with the Biosecurity Act. In fact, everyone's smart. Everyone is scrambling to find alternative sources today. So even when we speak generally about applications, I think it's just important to recognize that everyone has already either identified alternative sources of services that they need along their R&D path. And so I would suggest that if you are the outlier and in the wait and see mode, you go and find another solution. And of course, things are very different. Many companies are in the middle of the trial where manufacturing is currently done in China. So, of course, it's case-by-case basis. But if you're not tied in, and our understanding is those cases are going to be grandfathered, if you're not in that outlier cases, I would definitely recommend. And what I'm seeing on the ground is people are looking for alternatives. Now, the good news is that despite kind of the doom and gloom conversations about everything from cost and efficiency, the quality of work, we see many biotech companies and pharma companies, they're quickly finding equally good solutions. And you'd actually be surprised to learn that there are many providers similar to WuXi that have tons of unused capacity today. I was just speaking with a CRO in the United States outside of Massachusetts. They're only at about 20% utilization rate. They have lots of availability, very high quality. And we also have companies large and small locally. We have, you know, Thermo and Ginkgo that are offering solutions as well. So there are plenty of options here. So something to really, it's great to have these more general conversations. But if you're on the ground, recognize that everybody else has already either found a solution or close to finding one.
Does anyone else like to comment on that?
Hi, Brad. I mean, I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, we've used WuXi for, you know, 4 years ago or so. We started a plan B and C 2 years ago. Look, generally, I agree with what Daphne's saying. All national security is important, but I will say that WuXi are excellent and they're very big, and it's not, you know, it's quite significant, kind of the turmoil in the ecosystem. But yeah, you know, we've had a lot of success with other providers. There's more, if you like, slack in the system. Go back 2.5 years ago during the pandemic, and obviously there was, you know, there was during the biotech boom, everything was very, very kind of tight, if you like. But yeah, now I think at least we're in that sort of time of the cycle where there are many alternatives, and I agree, people should be, if they haven't got alternatives, going for it.
And then Daphne, do you want to go into Regeneron?
Yeah, so this caught my eye because with all the pressure and attention on drug pricing, this was a bit of related news, which is not helpful for the reputation of the industry on this topic. So this week, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a complaint against Regeneron related to its macular degeneration drug Eylea. And the suit claims that Regeneron falsely inflated the average sales price of Eylea to manipulate the Medicare reimbursement process. The Justice Department says that specialty drug distributors would accept credit cards from doctors and retina practices purchasing Eylea while continuing to charge physicians a lower price, and that Regeneron failed for years to report how it paid hundreds of millions of dollars in this way. Eylea has a wholesale acquisition cost of about $1,850 per vial, and it was a leading expense for Medicare with more than $25 billion paid out from 2012 to 2023, according to this complaint. You may recall also that back in 2023, people who worked for Regeneron filed a whistleblower lawsuit under the False Claims Act related to Eylea. And those whistleblowers accused Regeneron of using a charity that helps cover Medicare drug costs to pay kickbacks. And that case is still ongoing. So Regeneron says the allegations are without merit and that the reimbursement of costs incurred by specialty distributors were lawful. And it said it would vigorously defend itself in court. But, you know, these kinds of things, I think they don't help when we're under so much pressure around drug pricing. And, you know, we always talk about the middlemen and, you know, the practices of the middlemen and how, you know, they're really egregious and, you know, we're the innovators. But, you know, I think this kind of thing is just not great. Do you guys, I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on this and whether there's, you know, how broadly these kinds of things are practiced and whether we're likely to see similar lawsuits against biopharma companies doing things like this.
I guess, Daphne, simply the answer is yes, right? This isn't the first, it won't be the last. And you're right, it is very unfortunate. The optics are not good and not helpful for our industry. Not to blame the middlemen, but you've got, what, five of us on this call who probably combined have well over 100 years of experience in drug discovery, development, investing, researching, and reporting, and probably none of us have any sense of what's going on here, right? Because this system has gotten so convoluted, so opaque, so bizarre that we can't keep up with all the nuances. So from my standpoint, at least, it's really hard to know whether Regeneron has done anything at all improper or whether this is, you know, more of a specious lawsuit. I certainly want to give them the benefit of the doubt, as I'm sure we all do. But there also has to be change. And maybe for the first time, we are starting to see a little bit more pressure on those PBMs to, you know, earn their keep and act in a way that is not really at odds with the people they're supposed to be servicing, which are the patients at the end of the day. They're supposed to be negotiating for better access to lower cost drugs, and they just aren't doing that. That's very, very clear to me. I'm sure it's clear to you as well. And, you know, potentially there's a silver lining with some of these lawsuits that we untangle this mess and get into what's really going on, and the world sees that the PBMs are not playing a role that's helpful.
All right. Getting back to science, I'm going to kick it back to you, Luba. Another technology that we're talking a lot about lately, and actually this came up at AACR as well, I should have mentioned it, is protein degradation. And we had a deal this week, so Novartis and Arvinas. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, protein degradation has been hot. At this AACR, it's been hot, over the last 5 years. It's actually something even here at Dana-Farber, we have a big center on protein degradation. So it's great to see positive trending in terms of strong potential acquisitions and then also strong deals. So as you mentioned, we had just Arvinas just did enter into license and development and commercialization agreement with Novartis for an oral protein degrader program for prostate cancer. So the way the deal is structured is Arvinas will get $150 million upfront for licensing basically its second generation androgen receptor degrader, which is the program is called ARV-766. And also as part of this deal, there is also a sale of the Arvinas's preclinical program called ARV-7. As well. So the potential upside here is up to about $1 billion in development and regulatory and commercial milestones, and that also includes tiered royalties as well. So what Novartis will be responsible for is the clinical development and commercialization of this lead program that's currently in clinical trials, the androgen receptor degrader program 766. Just a little more on the program. So as I mentioned, it's an androgen receptor degrader. It is currently in phase 1b/2a in patients, specifically in metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer patients. It is best in class potentially for this indication, and it is orally bioavailable. What's great is also in preclinical studies, it demonstrated activity against tumors with wild-type and mutated AR. So that's great. The partnership is expected to accelerate and broaden the development of this program as a first-in-class option for the patients with generally with prostate cancer. And if you look into the data that Arvinas released last year around October of 2023, it did show about a 50% in prostate-specific antigen levels. And that's what supported this later stage study. So they're looking to get progression-free survival data with this degrader by the mid of this year and are going to plan and start discussing phase 3 studies with the FDA later this year, probably second or third quarter of this year. It is not the first degrader technology, of course, and many other large pharmas are doing the same. But we haven't yet seen that many deals like this being done in the space. So it's very good news for this technology and validation.
Eric, I want to bring you in to comment on this. If you can just, I know you follow a lot of these companies in this space. Talk about like how big you think this might be. I interviewed a CEO of one of these companies at ASH last year, and obviously, he's biased, but he was like, look, everywhere an antibody is used today, if we're talking like 10 years from now, like, I hope we're talking about protein degraders. I mean, can it really be that big of like a tidal wave, or Like, what's the utility here, and how widespread might we be talking about this in the future?
Well, that's a great question, Brad, and I think it's one where the verdict is still out, right? Certainly, this technology has a lot of promise in terms of being able to selectively go after and degrade, and therefore essentially completely eradicate a cancer-driving target. So that is the promise. But so far, of course, we really haven't seen, I would say compellingly strong proof of concept. We've certainly seen good data, but I don't think that we've seen, you know, relative to other modalities that are targeting other cancer intervening targets, whether they're small molecules or ADCs or bispecifics or, you know, the whole myriad of technology platforms you can name. I'm not sure that we've seen degraders perform better than any of those. So I think they're in the running at this stage. Obviously, folks like Novartis putting money into the sector, that provides some level of validation. You know, on the other hand, look at all the money that's gone into ADCs recently, right? A lot more has found its way into that modality over the last 12 months than it has to the degraders.
I have a question. You know, you make a very good point, and especially with ADCs and others, when I was looking at this news, I was wondering whether or not Novartis is potentially making this move, not so much because of the promise of degraders, but because the ADC deals are so expensive. So it might be a hedge. I'd love to see if you think that may be what's going on, or it really is potentially degraders are promising.
I want to hear Brad's view on that. I'm honestly not familiar enough with Novartis.
Yeah, I don't really have a strong opinion on that either. One thing I'll give Novartis credit for is I feel like they really invest heavily in emerging technologies more so than like others do. So like think of their leadership in radiopharmaceuticals and how it's really lifted up that entire field. I don't know all of their thinking on this, but I do think it's interesting to see them kind of, you know, investing in a space like this, like they are. That was what I thought of when I saw the headline, is just how they kind of pick, you know, these interesting modalities and really do give it like a good go. So we'll have to see.
Brad, generally, I mean, my view on the PROTACs, actually, you know, having suffered with delivery issues with siRNAs, I'm generally quite positive on them. They're potent inhibitors without the delivery issues. You know, then you've got the next problem of target choice, et cetera. So that's a whole new area, and maybe that's some other things that are at play. But generally, it's a pretty powerful technology.
Yeah, and Ali, let's go over to your news now. So you announced that your company, eTherapeutics, is raising some money and going to delist from AIM. And you had a really good thread talking about like your thinking on that and what it says about maybe AIM and just kind of the funding situation in the UK for biotech. So for anybody that didn't see like your entire thread, why don't you just kind of talk about what you did and why you did it and give us the whole rundown on all that. And I know Daphne has some thoughts on this too.
Sure. I mean, look, firstly, I'd much rather be talking about RNAi in the liver and how we use transformer models, AI systems in a real kind of practical day-to-day basis. I think that'd probably be a more interesting kind of space to talk. Maybe we can do that. But look, I mean, in general, I guess it starts for me with I'm in this very unusual situation where we've just, in effect, done a raise, maybe at a 40% premium to the share price and a delist at the same time. So that should give an idea of how the whatever price discovery system there's been in place on the kind of London AIM markets have completely kind of fallen apart. You know, these two concepts don't really go with each other. You know, to cut a long story short, how has this all started? Where did it start? And I think it basically started with the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, really maybe the Volcker rule.
which kind of really put a limit on banks, how they support hedge funds, proprietary trading, risk really, and leverage, which was, you know, absolutely right thing to do at the time. What happened over the course of, you know, from 2009 to date is the Volcker Rule really got, you know, watered down a lot in the US. But in the UK, the equivalent kind of Volcker Rules in Europe really stuck. And that kind of pre-2009 liquidity never came back and actually, you know, maybe even got significantly worse. And then you go to a kind of litany of mishaps, bad luck, bad judgments, and things that just generally happen in life. We had, you know, at one stage we had, I'm sure you guys have heard of him, you know, an attempt by the likes of Neil Woodford to, and kind of Invesco, Daphne knows them, I think, and Lansdowne Partners to really kickstart a UK, let's say, life sciences ecosystem with a lot of capital. That went into its own problems where, you know, the Woodford funds, you know, they had their real kind of demise. They had, you know, a good amount of capital, but providing money is not enough. They didn't have enough infrastructure to really know which companies to back, et cetera. You know, we had Brexit, we had pandemics, maybe the actual pandemic kind of, and pandemic in the last kind of years, biotech, you know, the last year and a half where, you know, pre-Q3 2023, where, you know, we had probably the most savage bear market in biotechs, even hid the problems. But when the kind of this enormous influx of liquidity came into the US biotech markets, tech markets in Q3 23 up to date, huge amounts of capital being raised, the London market literally did not shift at all. No change in liquidity, no change in access to capital. You know, two other very small biotechs have delisted alongside us. You know, it's a pretty worrying trend. No easy solutions to it. Maybe slightly more worrying is, you know, we live in a world where the big get bigger and the small get smaller. And, you know, it's, I've seen, for example, Arch Ventures open up offices in London. You know, there's a good ecosystem of life sciences companies in Oxford, Cambridge, et cetera, but I'm not seeing that much capital coming in looking for value either. Maybe that's another problem, but because, you know, there's maybe there's more good ideas than there is money. That's one thing that's going on. So that's kind of how I see it. But generally, as a UK citizen, I live here, I live in London, you know, it's pretty worrying. It's a symptomatic maybe of a country more than an exchange. So, you know, that's what really my tweet was about, is worrying and depressed about it.
Ali, would you be, if you were elsewhere in Europe, do you feel like you would be saying the same thing? Do you believe this is just like a UK problem? Because, you know, the BioNTechs, Argenixes of the world have been some of the biggest successes in biotech over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. How is the rest of Europe outside of the UK?
Pretty bad, to be honest. But I would say the UK is one major rung lower than that, materially worse. But I mean, you're right. I mean, it's not, you know, geographically or, you know, in terms of GDP, I guess Europe is, and Europe and the UK is very large. But yeah, I mean, it's not specifically a UK problem. You know, liquidity is almost a weird concept. It's like a brand. It's sticky. It's when it's US markets have got it, you can't sort of somehow migrate it away. You know, in a normal ideal world, you kind of think, look, if eTherapeutics is a great company listed on the London market, money will come and find it, because money should have no real barriers, you know, if we've got a great drug, a great idea, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a real barrier to that. It doesn't quite work like that.
Daphne, PureTech has always been listed in London. What are your thoughts on this, and what have been your experience, you know, being a London-listed company?
Yeah, so PureTech's listed on the main market of the LSE, which is, it's a different market. I mean, it's different in terms of it's got much stricter rules than the AIM. And actually, I'll say on that point something slightly positive, and that is that the listing rules, so they have these UK listing rules, which are really cumbersome. So, you know, when you're doing a transaction, certain transactions meet a bar where you actually have to do a circular and get shareholder approval, you know, even if it's part of your actual business. So you can imagine how that can get in the way of a company being able to run its business. The UK listing rules are being amended, and I think it's going to happen towards this summer. So that should be helpful for companies on the main market of the LSE. I think, you know, taking that away. In general, what I'd say in terms of positives about London is that there are some amazing investors. I mean, you mentioned Invesco and Lansdowne. Obviously, Baillie Gifford is there. I mean, there's some really terrific long-term supportive investors. But in terms of biotech, the types of, you know, I think it's a little bit different from the mindset of biotech investors. So in the UK, investors are looking for things like capital returns. So, you know, for example, PureTech recently announced $100 million return to shareholders, as opposed to, you know, what a biotech specialist would be looking for, which is growth, clinical data, and things like that. So it's a little bit of a mismatch with regard to what the expectations are and what investors value versus biotech. I also think that some of the rules that are there tend to skew towards protecting downside as opposed to really enabling upside. And so there's a lot of rules to protect shareholders, which, you know, I think is a fair thing to have, but it can really get in the way. You know, I'll give you one example. Board members don't typically get equity in UK listed companies. So like we had to petition to get the right to be able to give them some equity. And the thinking is that somehow that creates a conflict, which I actually think it creates alignment. But so there's a lot of things like that I think could be fixed. Obviously, you have amazing science, Oxford, Cambridge. You have this ecosystem with terrific biotechs. So I was struck by Ali's thread because what you said was the UK markets are completely broken. There was a lot of people, a lot of investors and others commenting on your thread. So I really wanted to hear from you, Ali. But, you know, I'm hoping it will turn around. I'm hoping that, you know, that the amazing science and investors and management in the UK will get catch a break because there's so many great things there.
Yeah, just to add to that thread very briefly, I was just most recently on the board of a UK-based company that moved to the US Stock Exchange and now been sold called AppCam. Agreed, Daphne, with your points and also that there are some rules that make the alignment of board, I think disalignment of board and management with the shareholders. There are, for example, much stricter also rules for compensation of management. And that also may be may reflect, you know, less incentive for really management to perhaps take that company to the next level in the UK. But I agree. I think there's, Ali, one of the things you mentioned is perhaps there are a lot of great ideas and just less funding. And that is absolutely true. As Daphne mentioned, the amount of science that's coming out of Cambridge and Oxford and just the ecosystem in the UK is really impressive, especially in biotech as compared to the same in Europe. Much less so in biotech, of course, in France and even in Switzerland, which still leads the way in Germany in the biotech space. Very different, of course, in medtech and diagnostic. They have a lot more. So I hope there are going to be good news for the UK and perhaps some of the changes in the rules, especially as it affects management and board and even the number of board meetings on the UK stock exchange, both on AIM and the larger exchange.
Yeah, I think the upside thing is important. Maybe even at the source of the capital, what I sense is that, okay, let's say biotech is in some ways a high risk derivative of the tech sector in some ways, in a lot of ways, actually. But, you know, I don't even think the tech sector, which is easier, kind of, let's say, to understand the risks and whatever, that doesn't get much traction here. But there's a kind of philosophy. And in the London market, what you're seeing generally is a lot of takeovers in every sector. It's becoming a value market. And there's this kind of underlying lack of risk appetite everywhere.
All right. Well, we're getting close to closing things out. And one last thing that I wanted to say before we close out is congratulations and best of luck to Damian Garde. If you might have seen the news yesterday that after, I think, 7 years at Stat News, he's moving over to Bloomberg to cover the pharma sector. And I just want to say I've known, you know, Damian for a long time, all of those years, and I just think the world of him. First of all, he's a really, like, nice guy. If you've ever met him and talked with him, you know that. And it really, like, shows up in his writing. Like, I've always found Damian, like, fun to read, you know, even very, like, technical things. There's just, like, that Damian element in everything that he does, and it makes it educational and entertaining at the same time. So, you know, best of luck to him. That's, you know, it's a long time that he's been at Stat, and, you know, he's had a lot of major stories there that have had a huge impact on our sector. So best of luck to him. And with that, let's go around the horn and see if our panelists have any closing remarks. And I'll start, you know, going back to you, our guest, Allie. Any closing thing to say, not just about your news, but just, I guess, how you're feeling about biotech in general?
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the beginning, I would be very interested. I think it would be a very interesting topic in talking about artificial intelligence, specifically in biotech, because, you know, obviously tech and biotech people are like oil and water. And I run a company where I have literally two sectors in one. And I can even sense that kind of phenotypic difference. But, you know, what I think is important is, what are the practical uses of artificial intelligence in a sector which actually has to do experiments and clinical trials? You know, where does it, what's the reality of it? Because I actually think there's quite a lot of misconception of where artificial intelligence can be applied on a real practical basis. And I do think there's some misunderstandings of how you can really change a lot of the timelines and costs of clinical trials, experiments, data, patient selection, drug design, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, Eric, I'll go over to you. And Eric, I'm actually reading one of your notes that went out, like, as we've been doing this. And you put out, like, fun trivia, and I want to add a bullet point to the trivia you just put out. So you're talking about, like, Dendreon and Provenge, and the trivia questions you're asking is, like, who acquired Dendreon, like, who owns them today? Question I have is, like, what are the current sales of Provenge? I've heard that it's, like, shockingly high, like, hundreds of millions of dollars, but because it's, like, a private Chinese company that owns it now, like, nobody really knows. I don't know if you have any insights into that, but I think that'd be an interesting number to figure out one day.
No, I love the walk down memory lane, Brad. You're right. Yes, we put out a little trivia around Dendreon, and given Mitch was in the news this week, it's always good to reminisce a little bit. As you remember, Provenge was doing around $300 to $400 million when Dendreon was acquired out of bankruptcy, believe it or not. It wasn't a very profitable drug despite meaningful sales because the margins were so poor. And then what I hadn't appreciated was this company that acquired Dendreon from Valiant, which purchased the asset initially, the China company that you referenced, has renamed the company Dendreon. So it's still Dendreon selling Provenge of all things, which is kind of cool. And I don't have an idea of where sales are given the new Dendreon is a private Dendreon, but all fun stuff. Thank you for taking note.
Yeah, another thing that I think is interesting, it just is like a sign of how our industry has changed, is I remember when that drug was approved and they announced the $80,000 price, and it was just instant outrage. Like, how could any drug be priced at $80,000? And now look where we are today with, like, CAR-Ts, like $500,000, and gene therapies, you know, in the millions of dollars. And I mean, that actually wasn't that long ago. I mean, that was like a decade. You know, it's really, our industry has changed so much over that time.
Well, as you probably have also seen, and maybe this is a harbinger of things to come, CMS has now updated some of its websites and other electronic databases to be able to record drug prices at up to 99,999,099 cents. So maybe in the future we are going to see $10 million therapies 10 years from now, much like we've seen a tenfold increase, as you mentioned, in the last 10 years.
Whoa. All right. Luba, any closing remarks?
No, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation.
And then Daphne, I'll lead it to you. You were the big news maker this week. What else do you have to say?
Okay. Well, so first of all, on AI, our good friend Tim Oppler at Stifel is actually putting together an AI report, and I got to look at it. So that's going to be coming soon. So keep an eye out for that, AI and biotech. And I also want to mention that this week I'll be at the 18th Annual Biopharma and Healthcare Summit of the USAIC. It's on Thursday, and I'm chairing a panel with Rajiv Kaul, Chris Viehbacher, and Stelios Papadopoulos, and the pre-discussion was super interesting. We're going to be talking about wall cross pipes, M&A, the Biosecure Act, drug pricing, and other topics. And I'll ask my colleagues here to share a link with the speakers. It's a great event with pharma CEOs and CSOs, and one of those events where the speakers stay throughout the day. So I encourage people to register. I actually think they might be almost full on registration. But yeah, great discussion today. And I hope, I really enjoyed the discussion. I hope you all have a terrific weekend. And I think this was really interesting. So thank you all. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Take care.